Software vulnerabilities are difficult to eradicate and often have devastating consequences. While coding-related vulnerabilities are preventable and detectable, until recently, little attention has been paid to vulnerabilities arising from flaws in requirements and design defects. In today's podcast, we will talk to two researchers who are exploring the impact of design-related vulnerabilities and their impact on system cost and quality. Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcast. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a principal researcher here at the SEI. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Mike Conrad and Art Mannion. Before we delve into their research into data-driven software assurance, let's first tell you a little bit about our guests. Mike Conrad is a principal researcher who has been with the Software Engineering Institute since 1988. I've known him since 1992. Up until 2013, he was involved with software CMM and CMMI models development. Since then, he's been the technical leader for three research efforts that investigate the early software development lifecycle, particularly requirements and design, in challenging environments. The first is eliciting unstated requirements at scale, also data-driven software assurance, which we're here to talk about today, as well as concurrent deliberation of requirements and analysis of socio-technical ecosystem infrastructure improvement. We'll save that one for another time. Art Mannion is a senior member of the Vulnerability Analysis Team in the CERT division of the SEI. Since joining CERT in 2001, Mannion has studied vulnerabilities, coordinated disclosure efforts, and published advisories, alerts, and vulnerability notes for CERT's Coordination Center and U.S. CERT. Mannion currently focuses on vulnerability discovery and other areas of applied research, including ways to automate and improve operational vulnerability response. Prior to joining the SEI, he was the director of network infrastructure at Hunyadi College. Welcome, Mike and Art.
Thank you, Suzanne. Great to be here.
So, in 2014, the IEEE Computer Society Center for Secure Design was established. That's a new entity for them. To, quote, shift some of the focus in security from finding bugs to identifying common design flaws, all in the hopes that software architects can learn from others' mistakes. I'd like to start by having you explain for our listeners why this is such a big deal for the IEEE. What's the current state of practice and why this sudden emphasis or a seemingly sudden emphasis on design?
So I would start by pointing out that there's a lot of code-centric tools and emphasis. And this has been very good in many ways. What it fails to do is acknowledge adequately the bigger picture, the longer-term costs and impacts of decisions made in the early software development lifecycle, of the costs to patch and damage to or harm to a mission that comes operationally once that software is delivered and deployed in the end user or operational environment. So what we had hoped to do with this project was look at take this broader view, not just of the code-centric practices, but the context that led to the development of software, taking into account the impacts operationally that vulnerabilities might have.
So this is looking at, so we talk about the ILITES, or we talk about quality attributes, security obviously being one of them, and vulnerabilities are things that are malicious or not malicious that lead to frequently security as well as other kinds of operational breaches. So this
That's
is
right.
very consistent with other research at the SEI, research in architecture, research in static analysis, other kinds of techniques for addressing not just security, but the other kinds of quality attributes. What is special, what is unique about dealing with vulnerabilities in that requirements and design space?
A subset of the errors that are committed during software development can leave the resulting software product, depending in part on its end use and other matters, prone to a vulnerability that may result in a malicious attack, loss of information, and as I mentioned earlier, potential danger to the mission or to those engaged in the mission. So it's a subset of the human errors that are created. It's difficult to know in advance, and it depends on the use case, the operational environment, which errors may actually become vulnerabilities that release information or control even of the end product or system to some outside party. It could also be lie dormant for a period of time, and the error may not be or defect might not be recognized. At some later date, the operational conditions could change, the use case may change, and what was a benign, relatively benign defect suddenly becomes something that can be exploited.
So in contrast to, say, user experience, UX kinds of defects, which may be annoyances, these are defects that, as you say, can be prone to lay dormant and can have pretty devastating effects in terms of making public information that shouldn't be public, other kinds of mission
can give,
kinds of impacts.
Exactly. Can give a malicious individual, intending individual, access to information that the program is storing or perhaps even to the operating system underneath, and access to files or control of the system, which is perhaps the ultimate goal. But right. As we know today from lots of the news headlines, there's also been a lot of value attached to extracting information, credit card numbers, mm-hmm. private information,
email address.
Emails. Yep.
So how is your research trying to address this? You talk about getting into the design and requirements aspects of vulnerabilities. How did you approach that? What does your research help designers deal with?
Well, I think it's important here to acknowledge that this project was really two different groups at the SCI, two different research groups, broadly speaking, at the SCI. One that has been associated more with project management and process and measurement, and the other, which is much more related to software vulnerabilities and their detection and research around how to mitigate them and alert the community and guide the community in dealing with them. And Art represents the latter, and I represent the former. So for us a bit of an experiment as far as typical SCI projects go, in that we try to draw from expertise from two different parts of the SCI organization. And I have to say, it's been not only a pleasure working with Art Mannion and Julia Mullaney and others, I learned a lot from those folks. They have insight into what happens after the requirements and design. My interest has been requirements and design. Art, maybe you'd like to speak to
me. Yeah, no, thank you for the kind words there, Mike. But to your point, it was a very nice collaboration in that sense. If you look at a software development life cycle, my area and my team are dealing with bugs that are now security bugs, these vulnerabilities. They allow the consequences Mike was right. talking about. We're dealing with sort of after it's been baked in, shipped, deployed, used, discovered, and now we're playing a cleanup game. And then, Mike's area is looking at coming at from an earlier part of the SDL
right.
where can we do things at design architecture time that maybe lower the number of these things that or reduce the harm of them that get out the door.
So you've got sort of the catalog of things that we see in operations, things that we see in test, and Mike is really saying, okay, out of these things, I can identify that this set over here are things that might be from a requirements flaw or might be from a design flaw. Is that kind of how that collaboration
yeah,
went?
Yeah, that's generally how it started out, and one of our starting points was to look at our sort of catalog of operational vulnerabilities, things we had found, and it was, you know, it's largely a bit of manual inspection, but at least in my world, we look at things, we typically say an implementation flaw, so a coding mistake, and that can be fixed by hopefully secure coding practices, or the coding tools Mike was talking about might detect those code-focused tools. So those were fairly easy to identify out of a set, and then we looked at what was left. And with a little bit of manual reading into the case and remembering, you know, what happened at that point 3 years ago, and we were able to pretty well determine that those were likely to be a design time issue or an architecture time issue and not just a mistake in writing a line of code somewhere.
So. And those typically are going to have farther-reaching effects than where they're found also, right? Because you've got when I have an element of the architecture, messaging, for example, is going to affect a whole range of components in a system. So if I have an architecture defect that's found in the messaging component in one place, chances are I'm going to have to look everywhere else to see is that same flaw something that's been seen in the other components. So the effect of these architecture and requirements flaws can be much more far-reaching than often I turned a plus into a minus, you know, right, when I'm doing my coding. So how did you deal with that piece of it? How did you deal with sort of figuring out where to look to see the effects of these design flaws?
So that's kind of getting to the design of the project. And initially, our thought was that if we looked at a variety of root cause analysis type techniques, we might be able to find one that we could use for some of these design-related flaws that Art was just speaking to. We looked at a couple different techniques, and our colleague Bill Nichols led that particular effort. So we looked at IBM's orthogonal defect classification. Mm-hmm. We looked at HP. They looked somewhat at different parts of the life cycle, and we tried to pick from the best of those for our particular purposes, and that did lead to a kind of taxonomy that we then used in reviewing the history and provenance of particular design-related vulnerabilities to understand how they came to be, maybe what's the nature of the decision-making that led to them. And I should quickly mention here that we mean design in an expansive sense here. Mm-hmm. It's often in the broader context of the particular context in which the product was envisioned, or architecture was envisioned, that resulted
so
in
the
an
concept of operations
or
may have
maybe more
some
narrower focus than was warranted, considering the long-term reuse and the particular context and vision for a particular component changes over time.
Sure. So lack of consideration of kind of the evolution of the product can be one of the sources of these kinds of vulnerabilities.
Well said. A second component of the project design here is we did a mapping study. And again, Bill Nichols led in that. And so the question we wanted to answer is, what is already known about what practices might lead to design vulnerabilities? Can we even predict design vulnerabilities? Mm-hmm. And there we found the research literature to be actually, frankly, kind of sparse. It had some useful material, but for the most part, what was focused on was more predicting faults or errors, defects in code, some of which, as we mentioned, might become vulnerabilities, and trying to predict maybe which modules would have them. And we concluded that that really wasn't quite so adequate for our purposes. So then we began what we call these deep dives, and we kind of teamed up and paired off, and we looked at some of these vulnerabilities that Art mentioned earlier, trying to understand, again, under what was the particular flaw, what decisions led to that flaw being there. They were often conscious. There were often decisions that were made, occasionally even out of spite, perhaps, at a competitor. And so, you know, it was intentionally maybe thought of as a benign decision initially, but as the product got more and more widely used, it also planted the seeds for much great unintended impact. So we tried to follow the timeline for these. And we looked at some very specific vulnerabilities and did that. And then our hope was to also capitalize a model from our Bill Nichols and my part of the SEI, which is today called Software Solutions Division. And we hope to capitalize on data with the Team Software Process, or TSP, and use that to inform a model, an economic model, that would relate certain decisions for how software was developed to potential economic impact and operations. So that's kind of the broad sweep of the project. And we tried to do a little bit in every area, and ideally everything would lockstep
converge
with each other.
Yeah.
It didn't quite as well as we ambitiously had hoped, but truth is that we got some, I thought, some interesting results. First, the sense that vulnerabilities are both design-related vulnerabilities and requirements-related vulnerabilities can be horrific in their impact. I mean, it's in some cases, you literally cannot remove the vulnerability, and you have to live with it. That was one of the things I learned that I did not know, and from Art and Michael Orlando, who was another project team member at the time. One of the others was that under some very modest assumptions, and this speaks to the economic model, there's a win-win-win story in here. A little more attention to design practices and addressing, identifying early design defects makes developers happier because they can get to code release faster.
Sure.
Makes the customer happier because there's less disruption from faults as well as our concerned vulnerabilities in the field. And the software is more ready and available and operational. So, you know, we saw a win-win-win here, also for the acquirer, who has to worry about the long-term costs.
And sustainment,
right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Of this in the field. So we saw it as a win-win-win from some modest assumptions of the economic model. But to use it, unfortunately, you'd have to tailor the economic model and calibrate it for your organizational history.
So the an interesting aspect of this for me is that it's sort of like Back to the Future, because the SEI has been preaching pay attention to design, pay attention to requirements, pay attention to these things early and in multiple dimensions. Don't just look at security. Don't just look at usability. Look across these. Find out where the conflicts are. Deal with those early on. We've been talking about this for 20 years. What do you guys think are some of the barriers to actually getting people to adopt practices like this that would have huge benefit, but require them to change the way they approach design or require them to look at requirements in a different way? Do you have any sense of that, or have I just gone over the border there?
Well, the software that I see most often is probably be called COTS. And it's, you know, it's internet-facing or widely used.
Commercial off-the-shelf software.
Sure, sorry, commercial off-the-shelf software. So the point there is there's custom software development or more bespoke development, which may have a different lifespan and a different process around it. But, you know, the speed of the internet is a new version. A new technology came out. A new way to share your information came out.
A new competitor
came out. Time to market. And, you know, those competitive forces and the compressed time, my guess, it's just an educated guess here, is that the SDL time is squeezed and it's probably fairly easy to, you know, grab some components quickly and assemble them and ship something without doing what we're talking about, sort of some threat modeling, architecture review, considering design carefully up front. Even though that may pay off in the long run, there's just not time to do it. Or people... Developers feel that.
So there's what I would call implicit acceptance of risk instead of explicit addressing of risk.
Also that, I mean, a lot of the privacy work, you'll see people say, my information should be private, and yet in practice they'll participate in all sorts of information sharing, you know, click yes, free stuff, yes, I'll give you my information.
Yeah.
So, again, all of that compression of time and acceptance of possible risk, I think that's probably driving the lack of attention up front in the SDL.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just excellent. I could build on that. Yeah. I think art has touched on what, for me, are two reasons or two phenomenon. So art's point was is that a lot of software development today is developed to different value, business values, mm-hmm. As you said, Susie, maybe to a diminished perception of risk associated with quality mm-hmm. Deficiencies.
These components have worked over here. Why shouldn't they work for me?
Exactly. Right. And then there's also, I think, a far more – the second thing is that I think a lot more software development today does a lot of COTS-type integration, reuse, calibrating software that's already there. And we end up with these very layered stacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I think compared to 30 years ago, there's simply a lot more layers of software. For what we develop.
And less knowledge about the internals of the software
yes.
that we're using in composing
yes.
these systems.
And so I think for many, and we were also dealing with a lot more products and services and infrastructures that didn't exist 30 mm-hmm. years ago, where to some degree there's a little bit less fragility around, say, avionics mm-hmm. type software.
As Art said, the custom software has a lot more scrutiny. It has a whole life cycle of assurance kinds of activities
well
that
said.
You don't
yes.
know. They might have been done in the COTS product, but you don't know that.
Right, right. So I think software has kind of become sort of two different or a spectrum of different worlds or universes where there are still heavy and has to be heavy attention to the quality of software. On the other hand, I'm calibrating a website that has security built in, or building on a platform such as iOS that has security built in to a large degree. And so I don't have to worry so much about that. And, you know, the worst thing I'll do is just anger or inconvenience my user.
Right.
I'm inheriting the value that's been mm-hmm. built into the infrastructure, assuming that it's been done correctly.
Right.
That's the big assumption.
Yes.
So how can organizations in the commercial space as well as in the more custom space use the research that you've done to help them create products with fewer vulnerabilities? What are a couple of practical things that they could use if they wanted to?
So the Mike had mentioned an economic model that's in that work, and without delving deeply into it, and this is also, you know, this is longstanding SCI research that, you know, investing design and development time up front earlier in the cycle pays off. Fewer bugs, fewer defects, cheaper to fix, more robust software. So that's, you know, the economic model was an attempt to sort of find some of the pieces to that mm-hmm. that argument or that equation, and, you know, see if you could turn up, you know, a variable that implied more design time, and what does that do to your defect rate? You know, that sort of thing is the idea behind the model. So, one thing a development organization could do would be something similar: try to assess if we shift our investment in the SDL to earlier, mm-hmm. is that a win for us? You know, is it feasible in our market, and does it result in fewer defects,
right.
less harmful defects, more robust software? Something that at least in my area it's sort of an educated guess, but we think is perhaps another quick way a software developer could get into some of these things is threat modeling. And it's one thing to sort of, you know, I'm going to apply security broadly at design time, but if you're building software you know is going to exchange messages on the internet or be part of a web service or something, there are a handful of attacks you can very, very, very well predict.
Sure.
They're going on all the time in the background. So at the very least, you identify where sensitive data is, what are the interfaces with the internet, the network,
mm-hmm.
Other systems, what are common types of attacks that might happen, and at the very least, enumerate those and figure out how your design, deals with those types of events.
And I will tell you, that's an area that I was surprised. I've done some work evaluating technical teams, and I was on one of these evaluations, about a year and a half ago, and the that whole concept of threat modeling, that they had a threat model for that was an enterprise-level threat model,
okay.
But they were kind of off to the side doing something a little different, and they didn't see any need for having their own threat model. And that really surprised me. I mean, that was like, really? You guys aren't doing exactly what the rest of them are doing. Don't you want to think about what your threats are? And so that seems to be an area that is not as well understood or well accepted in the software architecture and design area as some other practices might be. So,
I
second that.
Yeah. I third that.
Yeah, I think it's still, I've seen, when I've looked at threat modeling or attempted to look into it more formally, I've seen, you know, NASA work and the safety software world is paying attention and does hazard analysis and things. But, you know, some stripped-down version of that I think would be applicable to internet software and, you know, COTS speed software. Maybe not the very most thorough analysis, but parts of it should apply. And I think a lot of the mistakes we see coming out just seem to be, we didn't think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't even considered, and now you've got a mess. So,
Okay. And unfortunately, I think that the trend that you two have been both speaking to is going to continue. Things are going to become more interconnected, and these two worlds that one might have thought of as separate and amenable to different concepts of what best practices are, perhaps, and what techniques to employ, I'm not so sure that holds up.
Yeah.
As we increasingly intermix the artifacts and behavior components from both worlds, become dependent on both components.
Yeah,
from both
and there's
worlds.
Architectural patterns. You know, service-oriented architectures make assumptions about you know interconnection and things like that. That if they're held, if those assumptions hold, everything's great.
Right.
But if they don't hold, if the COTS infrastructure service didn't pay attention to some of the vulnerability possibilities and things like that, your service is interacting with something unsafe. And that aspect of it is another architectural aspect that architects can't just look at their own services. They have to look across the whole span of the system or the system of systems that they're interacting with to be more assured of safety. I mean, we're never going to be completely safe.
Yeah, there's. I hold a view that's I've heard others speak to of there being an attention economy, and in a certain sense, the amount of context we needed to keep up with as we try to develop code, I believe, used to be much more narrow and reduced, and I don't know that our brains are built well. To handle lots of possible targets, and also moving to a situation where you have a weakest link in the chain type phenomenon going on. So I think one good thing about our project that might be a takeaway is to try to make more visible, more salient, more compelling this overall sense or measure of what the value of the weakest link is, and help encourage
and the
attention.
The impact of the weakest link.
Exactly, and drive attention to that, and so that's the potential value of things like enterprise models, looking from a very broad picture of where is our weakest link, where are there particular parts of the organization that are not focus on this broader picture that we need to bring in, such as the product development group.
Sure. Excellent. Well, I'm excited about this research. I think that this is an area that it connects very well with other work we've done at the SEI, but gives a different spin and focus on it that I think is very timely for the software industry. So I thank you both for joining us today. For a deeper dive into the work that Mike and Art and their colleagues have been doing, we welcome you to visit the SEI Library, where you can download a copy of their technical report by going to resources.sei.cmu.edu/library. In the keyword field, type the name of their report, which is Data-Driven Software Assurance. or you can search on Art Minion, Mike Conrad, although if you search on Mike Conrad, you'll find lots of other stuff too. Interesting, but not all about data assurance. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you for listening.